That's a soulful hit from the Alabama Shakes, 2012's Hold On. And that's sort of what we're talking about tonight. What Forrest J. Ackerman has been doing is holding on or reaching out to some of his friends and colleagues, not quite going away, letting them know that there's something beyond, something on the other side, or at least that's the way it seems. There are critics, there are skeptics, there are people who are pretty hostile to the whole story, and we're going to get into that in a moment. We're waiting for Forrest to reach out and let us know he's listening to the program tonight, waiting for something to happen. And I don't know, we got an hour left. We'll get to some of your questions and comments in just a little bit. Much more to come here with my guest, Paul Davids, on Coast to Coast AM. So, Paul, before the book, An Atheist in Heaven, there was the film, and it includes these interview segments with Dr. Michael Shermer, who's been a guest on this program many times, a noted skeptic about all things strange and paranormal, certainly about UFOs and aliens. And in the film, he expresses the view that, look, you can have a whole string of coincidences, but that doesn't constitute evidence because, you know, the human mind is sort of trained and programmed to look for patterns, right?
Right. He talks about that in his book, The Believing Brain, Why People Believe Weird Things. But what we have here, there are some coincidences or synchronicities, yes, but we have a whole string of incidents that involve physical evidence. Some of it is instrumental transcommunication. Some of it is in the apportation, the movement of actual physical objects. Some of it is in changing our physical world, as in the ink, which was, it also happened to another man named Jack Kelleher, involving Fari Ackerman, who contributed a chapter to the book. So the coincidences is sort of out, you can't consider it proof, but when you consider it in relationship to everything else, it just adds to the cumulative picture. You know, Dr. Shermer was kind enough to be in my film, and he didn't express complete skepticism about life after death. He said he had no evidence for it, but he could imagine that if it turned out through some quantum physics property we're not aware of, that the information of our individual patterns continues after death in some quantum field. And he said, well, you know, then it won't be paranormal anymore. That'll be chapter 25 in your physics book, which is a fine way of talking around the point.
Well, it could be true for UFOs eventually, too, huh?
I think the thing with Dr. Shermer that I want to make the point that when he saw the Life After Death Project, he wrote to me, he signed his book, Believing Brain, to me, to Paul, in respect of your honest search and integrity. It meant a lot to me because here's the king of the skeptics in America who's acknowledging that this man who has an incredible story, probably as extraordinary in its own way as the Whitley Strieber story that was documented in Communion, that this man, Paul Davids, who has these impossible things to say, has undertaken an honest search and is a man of integrity, which means he accepts the fact that I'm not making this up. I'm not committing a hoax. I'm not lying. This is the truth that I'm presenting as to what has happened. And he respected that. He doesn't necessarily share my conclusion that it means Forrest J. Ackerman's in touch. But and before I get to his weird experience that happened to him, I want to say that I think a lot of the skeptics have been a lot less fair and have distorted my testimony about what's happened. For example, when the film The Life After Death Project came out, it was on Sci-Fi, and then there's a DVD. They would write blogs and articles and reviews. They often referred to what happened with the ink as a smudge. Well, a smudge is a smudge. You know, a smudge is a smear, a sort of accidental. It has no deliberateness to it. But what's obvious when you look at the change of the ink on my document is that it was deliberate. It was precise.
Targeted.
Targeted. That's the word that Dr. John Allison used. Something made the decision that those words were to be highlighted for me, picked those words, and did the job. And that person, that entity, that ghost, that's whatever you want to call it, was unseen by me, invisible, and yet was acting in my house while no one else was physically present. That really did happen. And my challenge to the skeptics is, I say to them now, okay, so if the movie wasn't enough for you, if seeing a documentary wasn't, now we've spent 3 years writing the book, we've put it all down in black and white, we've got the chemist who worked on it for 3 years, what you call a smudge. Now take this seriously, scientifically, because he has enough to devote 3 years to it. You have no explanation for it. And now let me go to what happened in Dr. Shermer's life that he has no explanation for, and shook his skepticism to the very core, he said in Scientific American. He got married during a summer to a German girl who had been raised by her grandfather, who was deceased. They shipped her possessions and her grandfather's possessions over to Pasadena, where the headquarters of Skeptic Society is. Among the items was an old transistor radio. It did not work. Michael Shermer tried to make it work. He spent a long time at it. First, he changes the batteries. He works on it. He checks the solder connections. He wants to make her grandfather's radio work. He can't do it. Finally, in despair, you know, he sort of bangs it against a surface, and it still doesn't work. So they get married. They go to the courthouse. They get their license. They come back to his house, and they're going to say their vows in front of a group of friends. And she says, you know, I'm so lonely here in America. Oh, you know, how I wish my grandfather was here to give me away. And right then, they start hearing music of a love song. And they can't figure out where it's coming from. They open the doors. They, you know, there's no music playing in their house. They think, is there a neighbor? No, they can't find it. And they finally track the music to the drawer where he stuck the broken FM radio that belonged to her grandfather. And it's playing a love song. It's working now. And they don't touch it. They let it keep playing. It works for 24 hours. Then it stops working. It never works again. And his wife, who's a skeptic too, nevertheless said to him, you know, my grandfather was with us here today to give me away. And Michael, you know, he didn't dispute that. Of course, his skeptical view of the world doesn't allow him to accept it as a fact. His philosophy is there is no agenticity in this universe outside these random, wildly moving energetic molecules that through coincidence over time has resulted in the world that we know, but that it's random, evolution, chance. There's no mind or mentality behind it connecting all these things together except our own minds where we see patterns and things. He doesn't believe in agenticity. That's his word. I do. That's what separates us. After these years of experiences with the phenomena related to Forrest J. Ackerman, I see an intelligent agenticity at work, interacting with us, interplay with us, sometimes playfully, and conscious of us, aware of us, sometimes guiding us, sometimes just making us aware that there's something else larger there that is aware. And I think the evidence proves that. The skeptics don't think so, but I don't think they're looking at the evidence. They're certainly not looking at the same evidence I am.
Of course, there's you know, a couple billion people on the planet who believe that there is, in fact, life after death.
Sure.
They believe it in a religious context, that the soul goes on.
Sure.
I don't know how comfortable they are in saying that the soul can then communicate with us.
Right.
Have you been sort of attacked from that side?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, because those that take a literal view of heaven, you know, you die, you go to hell, or you go to heaven. You're not sticking around here to communicate with people. That's their belief system. Every religion has its own belief. But here's something really interesting, sent to me by someone who is my classmate in high school in Bethesda, who is concerned for me. I guess she's very religious, unless this is intended as a joke. But here's what she sent me tonight. She said, this is why I fear for our dear Paul Jeffrey Davids. Deuteronomy 18:10-13, King James Version. There shall not be found among you anyone that maketh his son or daughter to pass through the fire, or that useth divination, or an observer of times, or an enchanter, or a witch, or a charmer, or a consulter with familiar spirits, or a wizard, or a necromancer. For all that do these things are an abomination unto the Lord, and because of these abominations, the Lord thy God doth drive them out before thee. Thou shalt be perfect with the Lord thy God. Well, this is like saying, Paul, you know, you're playing with the devil, you're dancing with the devil here. You know, you're going where man was not meant to go, which is a cliche line from a lot of old science fiction movies. You know, and to that I say, ridiculous. You know, don't bother me with Deuteronomy. I'm talking about life as we experience it. I'm talking about what we learn from life, what it teaches us. I'm talking about evidence of our loved ones still being here after they've passed away physically. What you're telling me, this is an abomination to the Lord to go there, and that the, what is it? It says, the God doth drive them out before thee because they're an abomination. Well, to that I say, no. If there is a God, he hasn't driven me out. He's provided for me the circumstances under which I've been able to make a film to reveal the evidence, spend 3 years writing a book, get the book out to the world, put it before people so they can consider it, so that they can understand that there is evidence of agenticity, a larger consciousness, a larger plan. And that's the spiritual purpose as I see it, not this this particular text, which speaks of witchcraft. Although Fari liked, you know, he liked witchcraft and all that stuff, but only as fiction. It was all fun for him.
Let me ask you one other question before we open up the phone lines. It's about your co-author, Gary.
Yeah.
Distinguished academic career. He's on the cutting edge, what you'd call a frontier science. Other people might call quackery. But he's really putting himself out there and kind of trying to be able to document communication with the other side.
Yes, he is. And he has been attacked mercilessly. Penn and Teller are two of those who have most tried to take him through the coals, even Lawrence O'Donnell. There's a chapter about that in the book. But what was clear was they never read his book. They didn't know about his research. They didn't check out his background. His background is stellar. His academic credentials are stellar. There have been a few controversial incidents that have happened to him where he's been accused of this or that. But, you know, in our book, he takes the time to explain his point of view about those things. There's two sides to every story. He is a tenured professor at the University of Arizona in Tucson. He continues his research there. It is very cutting edge. And it does involve, you know, the cell phone is one of the inventions he'd like to accomplish in his lifetime. It may sound far-fetched, but we would have thought that the internet, the iPhones that we have today are completely far-fetched. You know, 20 years ago, we wouldn't have believed in it. One last little point regarding the cell phone thing. When John Allison had his Furby toy talking to him saying, Fori, Fori, it was while he was writing an essay about the cell phone concept where you could dial up a spirit on the other side, like with a telephone that rings. And he said, right at that moment, the Furby said, ring, 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 ring. Okay, it happened. Can't explain it.
All right, let's take a call or two. We've got from the United Kingdom, Ned calling from the UK on the wild card line. Hi, Ned.
Hey guys, nice listening to you tonight. I visited Ackerman's house sort of just out of this bizarre sort of coincidence. I used to work and live in Los Angeles, and my boss at the time was in real estate, and she got this tip that this might be this house comes on the market, and if she can sort of design the house and buy and sell it and perhaps even live in it. Anyways, we sort of went into the place and sort of we had a quick tour of the place, and she wanted to see what sort of upkeep would have to sort of be done to the house to sort of put it back on the market and stuff. Anyway, sort of we were sort of just walking out of the house, and she grabbed these sort of two Polaroids that were sort of just kind of just on the sort of corner of this sort of room, basically. And she said, here, take these. These are important. And so these pictures, they're two creatures. And I've always kind of felt guilty about having them, but I suppose they're just going to go to the trash. But I just wonder if maybe if this guy's open to communication, if I should sort of tap into the energy that he once had, you know, in this Polaroid, in this chemistry that he touched with his hands. And because, you know, I believe in this sort of, you know, we should contact the other side because there is one there. And you think it's dangerous to open up communication?
I think this is terrific that you have this. I'd love for you to scan them. You got a JPEG. My email, starrynightmovie@AOL.com. I'd love to see them. I'm in touch with the owner of the house.
Yeah, I'll contact you. I'll contact you.
You know, when we had the seance there, one of the scientists who participated in it, Dieter Steckles, is a university professor, Arizona Tucson. He's an expert in gorillas, as is his wife. And they ran the Diane Fossey Organization for Gorillas Preservation in Africa. If you saw the movie Gorillas in the Mist, you know about Diane Fossey. So he came to participate and evaluate the evidence. As a skeptic who was open-minded, he said, look, I'm willing to believe it if I see the evidence. And during the seance, at a very key point in it, the couch he was sitting on began to vibrate significantly and just shake underneath him. He had his son reach out and touch it. He called everyone's attention to it. And at that point in the seance, Suzanne Wilson, who was sort of leading the seance, was talking about the signs that they were going to be giving from the other side. Well, anyone with a skeptical mind after the seance is over is going to want to say, okay, you know, is there some kind of a vibrator hidden in a pillow in that couch? You know, did somebody electronically push a button or what? I checked the thing out. I had to know. I just had to know. And I slept on the couch that night. You know, I opened up all the pillows. I looked underneath the couch. There was nothing there that physically would have caused it. It was part of what happened in the phenomenon of the seance. And this scientist was really shaken by sitting on the couch, but, you know, he was shaken up over it.
Literally and figuratively. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Fari would love
Ned,
the fun.
Ned, thanks for the call. Danion Brinkley was in the film. What's his take on the whole thing?
Well, Danion, who's written a famous...
a couple of books about near-death experiences.
Yeah, he had a death experience when he was struck by lightning. And the doctor said at one point that he wasn't breathing. He had flatlined. He had no EKG. His heart wasn't beating. And they were ready to send him off to the morgue. And his body was there for 20 minutes. And yet he came back. You know, he's like a man returned from the dead. This is one of the most profound, near-death experiences. Oh, his book was called Saved by the Light.
Right.
And they made it into a television film. But he, in his book, he recounts the fact that he traveled somewhere, outside his physical body. He had a spirit guide. He had a life review. He saw crystal cities. He saw boxes of wisdom and knowledge. He was told that he had to go back into this pain-racked body that was so incapacitated that it took him months to be able to feed himself and walk again. You know, he didn't want to go back, but he said, yes, there's a life beyond this one. George, I want to fill in one little detail that slipped along the way. I said that Fari, his parents, his grandparents, you know, spiritualists.
I'll tell you what, hold on. That's a good item. I know where it's heading, and we're going to hold off until after the break. ELO, can't get it out of my head. Take us onto the other side. We'll be back with Paul Davids and more of your questions and comments right after this. Stunning harmonies there from the Beatles' Sun King, and depending on your time zone, maybe the sun is rising soon where you are. We're talking with Paul Davids about his book, An Atheist in Heaven, and the film that preceded it. When we come back, we'll let him finish the story about the grandparents and then take more of your calls and comments and questions. Stick around. Our final segment of Coast to Coast coming up. Paul, before the break, you started to tell a story about the grandparents.
Yes, Fari's grandparents who believed in spiritualism. I mentioned that his maternal grandfather had designed what's called the Bradbury Building in Los Angeles, not named after Ray Bradbury, but it was in its day a very futuristic building. It still stands. And I said that there was a famous movie shot there, and I had forgotten the name. Someone has texted me that it was Blade Runner.
Oh.
So I wanted that to be known, and also that his grandparents, as spiritualists, had participated in a Ouija session to try to decide whether his grandfather should accept the offer to design the Bradbury Building, because he worked in an architectural firm but had never designed anything before. He'd only done sketches that were much liked. And they got the Ouija board answer, take the Bradbury Building and you will succeed, written backwards. And although Fari didn't believe in any of this or spiritualism, he kept that message from the Ouija board and kept it framed in his house for all those years. So there's a little inconsistency there on what he really believed.
Let's take a couple of calls. Joe in the Bronx has an interesting question. Hi, Joe. You're on with Paul Davids.
I'd like to ask your guest, was there any interaction or was Forrest J. Ackerman associated in any way with the director, Ed Wood, who was a good friend of Bela Lugosi?
Absolutely. He knew Ed Wood, and John Landis tells the story that at a party he had for his first movie, Schlock, that Fari Ackerman showed up with Ed Wood, and Ed Wood was absolutely astonished to hear that John Landis was aware of his various very low-budget movies, Plan 9 from Outer Space. One other point, Ed Wood's production office in Los Angeles was on top of what is now the Vista Theater, near the intersection of Sunset and Hollywood Boulevard. And there are handprints and footprints there, just as there are at the Chinese Theater. And Fari Ackerman's footprints and handprints are right there, right below what used to be Ed Wood's office.
Joe, thanks for the call. First-time caller Scott in Ventura County, California. Hi, Scott.
Hello. Hello. Hello.
Howdy.
Hi. Long-time listener here to, I guess, a couple of Georges, maybe Ian and Art Bell. Just thankful and heard the mention of tonight's guest, which is fascinating in regards to that electronic communication after death, and have experienced a little bit of that on my own after a friend of mine took a fall during a rock climbing session out in Phoenix, Arizona, and I felt pretty guilty about it, and was speaking to neighbors and questioned about what had happened, and on a personal, one-on-one conversation, as I was telling them how I wish he would reach out and let me know that he's okay and that he's upset and so forth and so on, my phone instantly started ringing. And when I went to look at the number, it was my own phone number calling myself.
Wow. He died in the rock fall?
Yeah, he died. And it was just, pretty much instant.
It was an instantaneous response. Which is something that I felt, that sometimes that nothing will happen for a long time, and then you'll do something, you'll think something, and then it causes an immediate response, as though someone was right inside your head.
That was just the beginning of it, and that was a lot of clarity. That his parents flew out right away, and when they returned home, we had good communication, and the mother had shared with me how it was just after the holidays, and how she was putting away Christmas cards that were on the table that she couldn't get herself to open because of the mood, and as she was picking them up off the table and putting them in a basket up on top of the mantle, she had turned around and realized one had dropped on the floor and had picked that card up, and it was from her son.
Right.
And mm-hmm. It had a message in it that was just unbelievable. That's basically verbatim from what I can remember this, because this is about 11 years ago,
mm-hmm.
that it had said, Mom and Dad, I want you to know you're the best parents that I've ever had, that a person could ever have, and that you, no matter what happens to me, I want you to know that I love you and I'm going to be happy wherever I'm at.
And this was written before the rock climbing.
It had to have been, but it was sent, you know, during the holidays, which was, it was very short after the first of the year.
Mm-hmm. And, wow. I think that stuff happens a lot more often than we realize. Scott, thanks for sharing the story. Thanks for sharing the story with us. I'm going to go now to Louisville, Kentucky, Dawson, who has some insight into Michael Shermer. Hi, Dawson. How you doing?
I'll hang it in there okay, George.
I'm glad to talk to you. We've communicated many times over the years, but I don't think I've ever talked to you on the air. So what's your story?
I got through once, I think, before. When I heard Michael Shermer's name come up, I had to laugh a little bit because I always think of him as the debunker I love to hate.
Mm-hmm.
Watching him on his, you know, on the TV documentaries and stuff like that, he just kind of drives me crazy. Mm-hmm. Well, back, it was around late 99, 2000, when I was involved in a UFO flap, which I had about 3 incidents of missing time. I was also having some telepathic communication. Now, I don't know if your ghostly dimensions and phenomena work like this or not, but I actually tried to get a message through to ET, the ones that I was dealing with at the time, to try to get Michael Shermer abducted. This is just the way my mind works. Okay? Uh-huh. They were taking us.
Uh-huh.
Might as well take him and shut him up. Okay? Take him, drop him off in a different state, and bring him back. Now, the message I got back was the reason they don't do that for somebody like him is because you and I and other people need to question why, with all the overwhelming evidence that we have, people like him just will keep their mind the way it is. We have to question why they question.
Mm-hmm.
That was the message that I got back from that. And just to give you a quick idea of one of the situations I had, what it was like, there were 2 of us one night in the morning. It had a cigar-shaped craft literally float over top of us. We were working security at a freight yard. And there was like a blue-gray beam came out the belly. And then the next thing we knew, it flew off. But when we turned around to go back to the office, it had been like 1 hour and 20 minutes later. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't say we were for sure abducted, but there were cases of missing time during this. And I also heard these telepathic voices. Well, I talked back to them. Now, whether I really was or not, or my mind was just, you know, trying to make up for the dealing with the fear of the unknown, you know, I can't really say.
Dawson, thanks for sharing with us. Let's get Paul's take on this. Paul?
Well, I'm aware of many, many abduction accounts. And I just returned from the International UFO Congress, in fact. And we heard from one of the people who was a child in Zimbabwe 20 years ago. It was a case John Mack investigated when a saucer in broad daylight landed in their schoolyard. They all saw beings. We're talking about a group of 30 children and their teachers. They were traumatized. And we got to hear the now grown-up, very grown-up witness who had experienced this as a child. It was the first time she'd gone public with the story. And you hear it, and you just, you know, it's true. I know Whitley Strieber. I know, you know, his stories are true. I mean, the bunkers attack what they don't like. They look for any way to belittle the testimony or ignore the key points. So this is what we're all dealing with. We'd like these instances, particularly the ones that have evidence that other people could follow, to get attention from the scientific community they deserve. In my case, with what I did in the book, An Atheist in Heaven, and the film, The Life After Death Project, I was very lucky to get scientists involved in taking a look at it, because normally they'll look the other way. They're afraid of damage to their reputation. But the chemists who worked on this, both
weren't concerned about that. So we need more people like that. And I would be very happy if the Skeptic Society, we were talking about Michael Shermer a moment ago, I'd like to see my book honestly reviewed there, but fairly reviewed. And I'd like to be able to go back there and have them not call it a smudge, you know, and deal with the chapter investigating the document, which has solid scientific procedure that was followed by a top chemist.
Yeah, I mean, if it's going to be a smudge, then at least the ink should be ink that's present in the printer that printed it out.
Sure, and literally smudged instead of absolutely orderly and targeted. But the debunkers, when my film came out, you know, they would write reviews completely distorting the facts, saying Paul Davis was in a hotel room. When this happened, he'd gone down the hall in the hotel room, and when he came back, he found the document tampered with. Well, you and I both know, if you're in a hotel, you leave your room, other people have the key to the room. It wasn't any relationship to what actually happened. I was in my own vacation home, the doors were locked, there was nobody else there. So if we're going to deal with it objectively, stick to the facts.
You know, you mentioned Whitley Strieber was such an important part of the film, and of course his experiences, alien abduction experiences, is how you would sort of categorize it. But I think, you know, as we've learned from subsequent books of his, what happened to him and years of experiences go far beyond the classic alien abduction scenario to something far more interesting and stranger. And I wonder if you think, Paul, that there is some kind of a connection between what you call a poltergeist or ghostly apparition, UFO abductions, that on some level where there's a connection.
Well, Whitley thinks so. I know he does. I've talked to him about it. My problem with making that leap is that with what I'm dealing with here, I'm seeing the signs of the personality of a man that I knew. Here's an editor that used puns and word games, and after he's deceased, I'm getting mysterious puns and word games. So there's a connection there that it's not some random poltergeist. It's not like, I'm not like a ghost hunter who goes into a cemetery and doesn't know who he's going to meet. This is a continuing relationship of something that was a lifelong friendship. It's really different. But in the similarity between Whitley and me, I think, is that we both have come forward to make very intimate confessions, very personal confessions about our personal lives that were difficult, you know, for both of us. And he was the victim of an onslaught of debunking, you know, claims that he had temporal lobe epilepsy or, you know, whatever it was that they threw at him that they had no foundation for. And I expect people to throw things at me, but the bottom line for me is I stand behind the sworn affidavit that I put at the beginning of this, that the account in An Atheist in Heaven is true. I haven't exaggerated anything. I've come forward with this because I want people to know. I want them to be able to work with the data and know that there's evidence from this physical evidence that life goes on. That's wonderful news, you know. And so apart from what it said in Deuteronomy, that I'm tampering with witchcraft and, you know, the Lord is going to have vengeance on me, no, I think what I'm doing here is making a scientific contribution to the advancement of knowledge, and that's the way I hope it'll be taken.
Take a question from Jason in Forest Grove, Oregon. Hi, Jason. No, Jason? Okay, we'll try David in Fairbanks, Alaska. Hi, David.
Hello, how are you?
Doing fine. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I just have a question for your guest, and I really respect the topic tonight, and I was just wondering, and I'll take the comment off the air, but and the whole experiencing of the supernatural and whatnot, have you ever come across a case that you had to get the Catholic Church involved or that you felt threatened and you learned from the Catholic Church prayers and whatnot? Because there is a heaven, yes, but there's also a hell, I believe. And have you dealt with something that maybe wasn't good or, you know, was threatening? And anyway, I'll just take that comment off.
It's a very good question, because though it hasn't happened to me personally, I have friends. I think I mention Russell Maynor in the book, who was a friend of Fari, who had poltergeist experience when he was in college that was very upsetting to him. As far as the Catholic Church involvement, and I know the literature, you'll find cases where priests have been brought in to sprinkle holy water and things like that. The only, I'm not a Catholic, but the only experience I had along these lines, when I made a film called Jesus in India, I filmed at the Vatican, and I was with Monsignor Corrado Balducci, the late Monsignor Corrado Balducci, who was both an apostolic nuncio of John Paul II, but he was also a chief exorcist for the Vatican. So here's someone, he was involved in science, astronomy, UFOs, which he did believe many were space visitors, and he was saying in lectures at many conferences that this was not contradictory to the teachings of the Catholic Church. And here's someone who also believed in demonology and exorcism. So yeah, that's part of it, but it's not been part of my experience in any way.
Try to get one more call in. A first-time caller, Bob in New Orleans. Hi, Bob.
How you doing? I listened to your show, and first of all, let me tell you, I'm a hardcore skeptic. But I'm in contact with three spirits, and I believe it more and more every day. And it's very interesting what happened. I'll give you just an idea because I don't want to stay on the line too much. But one of them was they're all friends of mine. All three are friends of mine, and I suffered a lot of grief after each one passed away. The first one that contacted me, he saw that I was in grief, I guess, and all of a sudden, for about 2 weeks, every once in a while, for no reason at all, I would turn and look at a clock, a digital clock, and the time would be either 10:10 or 11:11 or 12:12. Those were generally what it was in the beginning. And I said, "What is this? Is this all coincidence? Is this a devil? Is this somebody trying to contact me?" And I wanted to see how long I had known this friend. This is about several days later. I said, well, actually, it was about 2 weeks later. And I wanted to see, well, how long have I known this? And I looked. I used to put on a show at schools, and he was going to a school at the time. And the teacher called me to come in and put on this show where I showed the funny movies, short movies, and it was for the Christmas party. And I looked into the date now. I just was curious, wanted to see how long I'd known him. And the date was December 21st. And,
hey, Bob, I'm going to have to cut you off. I'm sorry. I shouldn't have taken the call. We appreciate you calling in, and I wish we had more time, but we're running out, and I got to say goodbye to our guest, Paul Davids. Paul, one last quick question. Well, no, we're out of time. So
can we send people to Amazon.com to look for An Atheist in Heaven or also the Life After Death Project?
All right. Well, we have links on the Coast to Coast website if people want to find that. Thanks. We'll have you back again to talk about this.
I always appreciate it, George. Thank you.
All right. Thanks to my colleagues, Jeff Duray, G. Lee, Dan Galati, our webmaster tonight, Greg Bishop, Chris Boros, our producer. Thanks also to my earlier guest, Keith Arum. And, of course, to Paul Davids. Good night, everyone.